Yeah, well, let me say first a word of thanks for this opportunity to present some of my recent work. And even more important, I would like to say I'm very grateful for the opportunity to participate in this research program. During the last couple of years, I did rarely get the opportunity to focus for several weeks really on research, and so I'm really grateful to have this opportunity to be thousands of miles away from other obligations. This is work which has done in collaboration with, on the one hand, a PhD student and a diploma student. And then we had visitors, Daniel Danchev from the Bulgarian Academy of Science and Mikolaj Bot, who is a frequent visitor from Ukraine. I will not say much about the work with Daniel Danchev, which concerns the effects of long-range interactions. If you are interested, I can make a few remarks at the end in the discussion. I'd rather focus on the other material and the recent work I got published, I guess, last night or so. So I, at least last night, I was informed that it went online. So to set the stage, let me perhaps remind you, and in order to establish a common language, what the Casimir effect in quantum electrodynamics is all about. Apparently, following a remark of Niels Bohr, Hendrik Casimir investigated the effect of confinement of the on the fluctuations of the electromagnetic quantum fluctuations. So he considered this situation, as you've seen several times, two conducting grounded plates, idealized. And he, sure enough, since we have confinement here, the modes of the electromagnetic waves are quantized in the z direction. If one has directly boundary conditions, one has discrete wave vectors. And then you can compute the ground state energy, and as we all know, there is a one term proportional to the volume, and as you take the limit of the whole system going to infinity, and there are also boundary terms, they would involve infinities unless you cut off the momenta at sufficiently large momenta. And then there is a term which depends on the distance of these two plates. And since there is such a term, there should be also a fluctuation-induced force. And what is interesting about this is this has universal features. It is just a number independent of microscopic details. But it depends, let's say, on certain properties of the medium and also boundary conditions and things like that. Now, this has been extensively studied by many people, and there are lots of review articles. Here are some I mentioned. And the force is quite tiny, but nevertheless, it can be measured and has been measured. I think you have seen this picture before in Martin Dekiewicz's talk. There were attempts many years ago, already in the 60s, to see it, but they could only qualitatively confirm the force. But in 97, Steve Lamoureux first had the idea to use, instead of two plates, one spheres. So this has the advantage that you do not have to worry about aligning the plates parallel to each other. Then, of course, you have to make a separate calculation for the plate sphere geometry. And the picture you see here is an improved arrangement which was studied by Mohideen and Roy. And one, in fact, finds good agreement if making a few corrections that are necessary. Now, since you've seen it before, let me cut the long story short. What makes the Casimir forces interesting is that they are independent of microscopic details. There's some sort of universality. They depend on gross features only of the medium, such as the space dimension, let's say the dispersion relation. Then also it makes a difference whether you have a scalar or a vector field, and geometry comes in. And then the boundary conditions. in the majority of the work on the quantum electrodynamic case, I mean, people are studying Gaussian fluctuations, so effective Gaussian theories, even though I'm well aware that more recently material properties have been taken much more seriously. But you can also ask the question, what about interacting field theories? And the example I'm going to discuss is the example of critical Casimir forces. And there you are quite naturally forced to study systems where you would have a Geigerfeld 2 to 4 theory where you have self-interactions. This is simply because below force-space dimension, the Ginzburg criterion tells us that fluctuations cannot be ignored, and we cannot even restrict ourselves in general to Gaussian fluctuations. And so let me explain or recall the analog of the Casimir effect, the so-called thermodynamic Casimir effect. This goes back to Michael Fischer and the late Pierre-Jules Dugène. In 78, they argued, let's consider a nearly critical system, such, let's say, a fluid near its liquid gas critical point here. And as we approach the critical point, these modes will become almost massless, the long wavelength mode. And if we confine it, then we can compute the partition sum here. And sure enough, the free energy will have a first term, which is proportional to the volume times the bulk free energy density. So it's a bulk contribution, which is, of course, independent of the thickness of the of this film system. And there's a second term, which is what is called the excess surface free energy. These are associated with semi-infinite systems bounded by either this plate or by this boundary. So therefore, they are additive, and they depend not only on gross features of the medium, but also on gross features of the boundary. And the next term is then what I call the residual free energy. This is explicitly dependent on L. And since we have this L-dependent piece here, we can expect that there should also be a force. So this is then the thermodynamic Casimir force per area will have this form. And then you can invoke simple ideas based on finite size scaling. So if you assume the only length that matters is the correlation length, you would write down a scaling function for this residual free energy of the following form. So this is from dimensional grounds, and this is such the ratio of L over this correlation length. And if you furthermore assume, which is it's natural to assume, that this function has a finite value at zero, so as then as you approach the critical point, you will get just an amplitude times such a force for the excess free energy, and accordingly you will have a force which has a universal amplitude and decreases like L to the 1 over D. Now what about experiments? We've yesterday and the day before yesterday heard a lot from Moses Chen. So the first detailed confirmations were in fact for the case of helium. There have been several other examples. People were looking at binary liquid, Pershan and co-workers, and also Jacques Meunier and Paris. And more recently, the group of Bechinger was able to directly measure the Casimir force by considering binary liquid mixtures and using optical techniques to measure it directly. Now, I won't go into details of the experiments. I think Siegfried Dietrich will also come, so he will certainly tell about these things at a later time. But let me perhaps summarize the state as far as helium is concerned. I prepared these slides even before the discussion, so I was quite pleased to see that my picture seems to agree with what other experts on this problem say. So here you see again the phase diagram of helium. So here's the lambda line, and one is investigating the thickness of the wetting layer of helium close to, as one goes through the lambda transition. And the arrangement is basically like this. You have liquid helium in contact with vapor and a copper plate, and the copper plate is wetted by the, so there's a macroscopic layer of liquid helium. And the thickness is determined by the forces, by balance of forces. We have gravity here and have to balance this with the van der Waals force for thin layers, non-retarded, for thicker or retarded. And we then have here a confined layer where critical fluctuations can occur, bounded on one side by the copper plate, on the other side by the interface between the liquid and the vapor. So if there is an additional Casimir force here, we should see it in the thickness of helium. And as you have seen, at least those who participated in the discussion and listened to Moses Chan's talk, one saw, in fact, that the thickness changes as one goes through the transition. Now, there were several to some extent surprising effects. The first thing was that, many people thought, something should happen directly at T lambda. So you see the big effect is below T lambda. So that took some time to understand. And we now believe that this is really has to do with the shift induced by a Dirichlet boundary condition. There is another thing which is important to take into account, namely at low temperature, it does not come up all the way to the case above TC. This is easy to understand because in the case of helium, one has Goldstone fluctuations in the bulk case. And if you confine the Goldstone bulk fluctuations, you also confine critical modes. Those are, so therefore, it should not go up all the way. What was surprising, though, is that the distance is larger than could be expected on calculations by Lee and Carter for Goldstone modes that are valid at very low temperature. And Roy Azandi and Joe Ratnick and Kada pointed out that there you have to take also into account the fluctuations of the interface between the liquid and the vapor. And last year, important progress was made on the side of simulations. Before myself, and I know Siegfried Dietrich even more, was asking all the experts to do simulations, and usually they refused, saying, well, you're asking to compute small free energy differences and then also to very high accuracy that's beyond possibilities. But it turns out that this actually can be done, and the agreement is now reasonably good. I'm showing here the results by Fred Hoogt, who figured out a number of tricks, putting in very accurate results from the for above TC, and then also introduced some important corrections to scaling. So essentially, one gets a reasonable agreement. These are simulations for an XY model. And of course, there are no fluctuations of the interface included here. So, you cannot expect that at low temperature you will recover the Casimir force seen in experiments. This is just a piece that is not in the simulations. And I believe the results by Anya. Pardon me?
Which ones are the simulations? The red?
The red are the simulations, yeah. And then, yeah. The red curve. There are two different data sets by Moses Chen. And for one data set, it actually agreed better than the others. Also, if you make scaling plots in one data set, there is a certain drift. This is, I would say, at best, that could be expected. And now one is able to make even more precise comparisons, particularly for the binary liquids.
Yeah. but probably it's different colors means different width, thickness of the film, probably, and they collapse the data nicely because of the this sophisticated way of including corrections to scale.
Yes, he has. I can tell. I mean, the what I know is that the first set of data gave a better scaling and a better agreement, even though the second were supposed to have a less rough surface. Yeah. The dashed line. This is the value at low TC, and this is. I mean, this is just extrapolated here, and this is the value of the. He didn't go. I mean, this plot he didn't go all the way to low temperature. So this is the line associated with the Goldstone mode value. Yeah, well, I mean, you have on the one hand, you have non-universal amplitude, like the amplitude of the correlation length, but he can compare that because there's very accurate results of also by other people above TC. And then you have, for example, you have a simulation, you have a correction which goes like 1 over L, and that has to be included. This is well understood that it should be there because in the Dirichlet case there is an irrelevant scaling field which scales like an inverse length and so forth.
And also in simulation
you
have no infinite film correction or box. Yeah? So aspect ratio dependence is quite important, especially for this kind of
Right, so those are corrections. But
so
my question was to get the experiment and the simulation to fit where the parameters to adjust the vertical and the horizontal axis. Or
then there is no.
There's.
But there, with these corrections, actually, this is also from our experience, we use different methods. One canon would change, shift the whole scaling function. We have checked 3 different phenomenological analyses for the corrections to scaling to achieve data collapse. This is the first point. Yeah? To achieve data collapse for the scaling function, we don't know because we have to achieve these 2 goals. And then, depending on the way we corrected our data, we had the shape is the same, but we found a little bit of shift. Of the data,
particularly for the second set of data, right? I mean, there's some even if you just take the experimental data, there's a little shift. Mm-hmm. Yeah, unfortunately, I would have liked that Fred Hoogt continues a little bit and
so
could look in closer, but I mean, he has a job which involves also taking care of computers and also has a new boss since last year, so he has many other things to do, and I don't think he did anything since last year on this problem. Okay, so let me perhaps point out a few relevant issues. I mean, why is the problem relatively complicated? Well, the first thing, of course, is it involves bulk critical behavior, so you have to treat bulk critical behavior correctly. But then the second is there are confined critical fluctuations, so you also have to deal with boundary field theory, and you have both finite size effects and boundary effects. And then on top of that, you have a dimensional crossover. In the case of helium, this would be a crossover, let's say, to a crystalline solids type behavior. In the case of binary liquids, where of a scalar order parameter in 3 dimensions, this would be a crossover to a critical point in the film. Dealing with this dimensional crossover is notoriously difficult by analytical methods, even simulations, you have to do a lot of work to get it correctly. And on top of that, if you want to cover the full the temperature regime, you also must make sure that you describe correctly the low temperature behavior, because if you don't do that, you wouldn't also see that there is no transition to an ordered phase in a finite film for helium. And then there's this additional aspect for helium that you have to think about interface fluctuations. Now, therefore, I'm trying to simplify the problem a little bit, or to put it in the words of Mehran, he pointed out, what we have learned from helium is there is a non-fluctuating background which is non-trivial below T lambda, and then you have on top of that fluctuations. So if you're really interested in fluctuation-induced forces, you should sort of focus directly on the fluctuation-induced force, and that's what I'm going to do here. So. We did it, of course, for technical reasons also. We felt we first have to understand the disordered phase. So we are making the assumption that T is larger than T0. And then we are also assuming that the symmetry is not broken explicitly by the boundaries. And in fact, I'm also assuming it's not, in this temperature regime, it's not spontaneously broken. So that the situation I'm looking at is where you really, if there are no fluctuations, there's no force. There is no non-fluctuating background. Yeah? In that sense, it's much simpler, but focused really on the fluctuation-induced forces. And here's a synopsis of what I would like to describe. The first thing I would...
Let me ask something.
Yeah.
Clarify one point. So suppose you go at TC bulk, okay, and you calculate the Casimir amplitude for, say, XY model in three dimensions, then these Goldstone mode type fluctuations, or I can call them, I think, phase fluctuations of the order parameter, are they included in that calculation? Or do you have to add them on later separately?
This is a problem you would have already in the bulk case, right? In the bulk case, if as long as you're looking close to TC, you can have approximations and you can get a good description, also the description of the scaling functions. Without worrying too much about what's going on at low temperatures. On the other hand, if you want to see that, let's say three-dimensional Heisenberg model has a lower critical dimension of 2, then you must make sure that you have also the low temperature fixed point directly correctly described. Yeah, if you do not carefully include the Goldstone modes at low temperature, you will not get the breakdown of you will violate the Murray-Wagner theorem, right?
Yes, but I'm asking about...
This is a question more if you are looking at crossover from, let's say, from critical behavior to low temperature behavior. But if you're just focusing on the critical regime, and that's not really a problem.
I think I don't understand, because the Goldstone modes at low temperatures, okay, I understand. So you have a kind of direction for the order parameter, and that you can choose arbitrarily along, say, a circle.
Sure.
So, but this actually has to do with the phase of the order parameter.
Yeah, well, if you do a calculation for the n component phi to the 4 model, then you have both. If you go below TC, then you have, of course, longitudinal and transverse modes. So it's principle, it's in there, right? Yeah. But nevertheless, to get the low temperature behavior, for example, you have additional coexistence singularities on the for the susceptibility. That's quite a difficult problem studied long time ago. Let's say Schaefer and Antoner, and then later on Laurie figured out how one can really put in the in approximate schemes invented by Goldschmidt and Amit to see the crossover and these things. Okay? So, and I will on the one hand show that for some boundary conditions, the theory, let's say in the underlying the calculation by Grech and Dieter is actually ill-defined. It breaks down the epsilon expansion. Then I will make a point here that boundary conditions are generally a scale-dependent property. You are all used, if you have in mind the Casimir force in quantum electrodynamics, then you say, well, I choose a boundary condition, let's say I choose a Neumann boundary condition, and then I get a force, and there's a universal amplitude, and that's it. If I choose a Dirichlet boundary, there's another universal amplitude. And I will show you explicitly that this is not the full story, because we will see if you choose on a certain scale, on this, let's say, mesoscopic scale or Neumann boundary condition, then you are prone to find on long scale the Dirichlet boundary condition. And what is more, we will also see that you can have a crossover. I mean, the issue, are there repulsive Casimir forces has been a question that has been investigated for many years. There are some cases where we can say on the basis of rigorous analysis and properties like reflection positivity that it has to be attractive if certain mirror symmetries are satisfied. And then people were looking for repulsive Casimir forces. But we will see that you can actually have, on a mesoscopic scale, for given boundaries, you can have, let's say, first an attractive Casimir force, and as you increase the distance of the plates, it becomes repulsive, and you can also have the opposite, from repulsive to attractive. And as I said, I will not say in the main talk anything about the effects of long-range interactions. So let me perhaps say a few words about the renormalization group. How it is used in condensed matter systems. So what one should have in mind is some microscopic model we would like to analyze and study its critical behavior. So the simplest I'm choosing here is the Ising model. So this is a microscopic description on the scale of the lattice constant, and then we can go over, since we are interested in behavior on larger scales, to a mesoscopic description. If you do that by coarse graining, you get such a Hamiltonian energy functional, the usual phi to the 4 model. Now we are interested in the behavior where the momenta wave vectors are very small compared to the large momentum cutoff. And we can study this behavior by borrowing methods from field theory. I mean, it's convenient to take the limit lambda going to infinity. But as we all know, this is a limit that cannot be naively been taken, because you have to disentangle the two roles lambda plays. It's, on the one hand, it cuts off integration, so it regulates your integrals. On the other hand, it gives us a length scale at TC. So you have to renormalize the parameters of your model. And you have seen for the coupling constant, for example, these Z factors, which depend on the cutoff. And we can then choose, we can then change the momentum scale in this fashion by looking at the same bare theory, and then we get running interaction constants. So this induces then a flow of the coupling constants, which gives us a scale dependent of the running interaction constants. We still have to compute, these beta functions. And of course, there are various methods to do it. One method, which despite its shortcomings, has proved to be quite efficient in for bulk critical behavior is the epsilon expansion, which is based on the observation that the infrared stable fixed point below 4 dimensions is of order epsilon. There's a non-trivial stable fixed point for the coupling constant below 4 dimensions. And this gives us, on the one hand, universality. So if you start with one U here, we flow here. So asymptotically, different microscopic systems are mapped on the same large scale behavior, and the flow for the coupling constant like that, then we have scaling fields like the temperature scaling fields, and how they flow, they involve so-called renormalization group eigenexponents. They give us the critical exponents. There are just two for a conventional critical point, so we have just two independent critical exponent, and then there are trajectory integrals which contain the non-universality. There are only two, and aside from these metric factors, the properties are then universal. So, and as a result, we can find scaling in this form, provided, I mean, the additional assumption you have to make is that these quantities taken at the fixed point have a non-zero, a finite limit. So this gives us a scale behavior, and we can also conclude two-scale factor universality. We could include corrections to scaling of this form, and so on and so forth. This has been extremely successful. Now let's go over to finite size systems. And the crucial idea was first pointed out by Michael Fisher in 71. He said, let's pick any property P in a finite size system and divide by its value in the infinite system if it's temperature dependent. If I assume that there's only one length that matters, then this should be a function of the ratio of L over this correlation length. So implicitly one assumes there are no other lengths that matter. And this was refined then later by Prieffmann and Fischer, who argued that the finite size free energy has such a scaling function similar to the case of the bulk free energy, and the same non-universal amplitudes go in here. And this has been quite successful and been tested many times. It is, however, true that there are cases where it fails because second lengths or even more lengths can come in. For example, this fails above four dimensions because thermodynamic lengths is also playing a role, and the reason is similar as hyperscaling breaks down above four dimensions. Poisson first showed that by explicit calculations for the n vector model in the limit n going to infinity. Anyway, it's a long story. Let me then show you how we can get finite size scaling from the renormalization group. The crucial observation is the following. At the moment, I'm taking a system which is finite in all directions, and then if you use Poisson's summation formula, you can express the free propagator as a sum of terms of this form, where this is the bulk free propagator. Now we know that the bulk propagator induces in Feynman graphs ultraviolet singularities, which then also require renormalization and so on. Now you see, if the terms with m equals 0 will give us the same bulk divergences, all the other terms, m different from 0, then this distance cannot vanish. So, I mean, this is nothing which can become, this propagator cannot become ultraviolet singular. Now, one can make this argument in more detail. I learned this first from in a paper by Szymanczyk, and it was subsequently used by Brezin, who really pointed out that this is essential to getting finite size scaling. And of course, the singularities mix and they can be disentangled using Forrest formula and so on and so forth. Anyway, the upshot is that the same bulk reparameterizations are sufficient to absorb all ultraviolet singularities for a system which is finite in all directions. The consequences then that the bulk renormalization equations carry over to systems in a finite system. So this immediately tells you L is not rescaled, you have a dependence on L over Xi. If you now know that this quantity, or can show that this quantity is meaningful at the fixed point, then you have finite size scaling. Now computing these things is of course a delicate task, I won't go into for this problem in detail. There have been many years ago, in the beginning of the 80s, Brezin and Chinchester on the one hand, and Ratnik, Guo, and Jasno on the other hand, who were looking at this problem.
Is it essential that the finite size be the same in each dimension?
It depends. I mean, if you have, you could, of course, different finite size in a trivial fashion, yeah, then it would also have dependencies on aspect ratios and so on. Some of them will be trivial. You could, the argument would go as well, but there are also cases where you have more than one length scale, what is called, if you have strong anisotropy, so you have eventually to rescale lengths in one direction a different fashion as in the other direction. But for the case where you have, let's say, the correlation lengths diverge with the same exponent in the various directions, there's no essential difference. Now let's go over to slabs. And the simplest case one can consider first is periodic boundary conditions. So assume this extends all the way to infinity. So we have a slab of finite widths. Then I have such a Hamiltonian. And then you can make the same argument that because the free propagator of the finite system can be expressed in using Poisson sum, and you again conclude that L is not renormalized and there's a dependence just on L over Xi. Now, if we have real surfaces, then the situation is a bit more complicated, and it makes sense to go one step back. So the step to go back is to go back to a microscopic model. And this is a reference model, the simplest one perhaps can think of, which is sufficiently general. It's an easing model where I have nearest neighbor couplings everywhere except on the two surfaces. And I take periodic boundary conditions, or you can assume they extend in this direction all the way to infinity. So I have a different coupling constant on the top layer and another one on the bottom layer. And again, I can make coarse graining and go over to a continuum field theory. And what I find then is quadratic surface terms. Here, the first term is just an integral over the system with a density which is the usual phi to the 4 term. And then there are quadratic terms sitting localized. They are localized on the boundary. And since I've chosen different k1 and k2s, I will get here different coefficients. And you find actually this, for this simple model, you find an expression like this. So you see, Cj depends on the ratio of the coupling. It depends on the enhancement of the coupling relative to the bulk. And if Kj increases, Cj decreases. Yeah, so minus Cj is a measure of enhancement, which makes sense because if Cj is large, then the order parameter will be suppressed at the surface. If it's small, then it's less suppressed. And you can first study then in a lambda theory, then you find such a so-called Robin boundary condition. And if you go beyond lambda theory, this boundary condition is actually fluctuating in the same sense as an equation of motion fluctuates. It holds in an operator sense, so inside of averages. Sorry, I could not. Okay, and you see, and specifically if you set C equal to infinity, then you have a Dirichlet boundary condition on one plate, and if you set 0, then you would have a Neumann boundary condition on. So both cases are included.
How precise is that Cj exact, or should I?
No, you get it if you just make, let's say, if you can make one easy way to do it is you make a Landau theory and then a continuum approximation, then you get it. The important point is I wanted to make also is, you see, it depends on microscopic details. For example, first, if you choose different couplings here in the perpendicular direction, you would get a different value. And also it involves, of course, a microscopic scale, so this tells you if I coarse grain to a different length scale, then I will get also a different value. So there's already an indication of the scale dependence of these boundary conditions.
But for the purpose of somebody doing simulations, you wouldn't tell them that if you have this model, this would be the value of CGI.
Well, I think it should be a good approximation because it's, you see, if doing this is just you're integrating out short length scales, degrees of freedom, so there is no problem from critical fluctuations or so. Yeah? But it's an approximation, and sure. Okay, now to let me then perhaps explain a little bit the context. I mean, we are now, let me look at the case, I'm pushing the second boundary to infinity. So temporarily, let us consider a semi-infinite system. So we have now just one of these C values, and here is a semi-infinite system, I integrate over half space. And here you see the phase diagram. You find both for this model and for the lattice model. So here's plotted temperature, and here's plotted surface enhancement. Now in mean field theory, this point is precisely at C naught equal to zero. So in mean field theory, at this point, at this critical enhancement, you would have a Neumann boundary conditions. If you go beyond, you would not have a Neumann boundary condition. But let me first explain what's happening if you're crossing this line. So I call this, crossing this line is you see is less than this value. So you are, it's subcritical, I call it. We'll see why, wrong direction. What you see then is here the order parameter profile. So I mean here down in the ordered phase, the bulk is ordered. And near the surface, this order parameter profile curves down, and it does so on the scale of the correlation lengths. And there, it behaves here algebraically, and what comes in is a difference of the thermal exponent beta 1 of the order parameter at the surface and the bulk thermal exponent. And this exponent beta 1 is 0.8 in three dimensions, beta is 0.3 something. So this is positive, so it really curves down. And you can say on large scales, on the scale of the correlation lengths, you have a Dirichlet boundary condition. Okay, let's look at the other side. On the other side, if we have a supercritical enhancement, then we enter here a surface ordered phase, a bulk disordered phase. So we have order at the surface, which decays on the scale of the correlation lengths. Here exponentially, and here you can find that it's like a power law. And only as we cross this line do we also get order in the bulk. So down here you find such a profile. Yeah? And you see then that we have here three critical lines. This is a line of surface transitions where the surface orders, and this is this point divides the bulk critical line into two portions, have been called ordinary and extraordinary by Tom Lubensky and Rubin originally. And if you are sitting right at this critical enhancement corresponding to this special point, you find such a behavior. In mean field theory, it would come in, it would be flat. So you'd have a Neumann boundary condition on long scales. If you include fluctuations, you see this is similar to that, except that I've taken out the minus sign, because now beta is larger than beta 1, so this asymptotically curves up. Yeah? So the conclusion is, I mean, this value here I call critical enhancement. Yeah, and the Neumann boundary condition we will see more, at least for this microscopic model I discussed, will be in the subcritical regime. Subcritical, if you ignore Neumann boundary condition, the whole behavior will be mapped. The renormalization group flows are in this direction and from this point in this direction. So we will be mapped on a fixed point where C is infinite, and asymptotically we will have a Dirichlet boundary condition. We will see that from the results I'm going to present. Here's the summary. So the question is, how do boundary conditions decide on the universality? How do they select the universal values of amplitudes and scaling functions? And there's a trivial remark, of course, first on a microscopic scale. I mean, you will have in general Kj different from K, and of course on a microscopic scale we have just chosen three boundary conditions. Then on a mesoscopic scale we have these Robin-type boundary conditions which would be non-universal. They depend on details, on microscopic details, the relation between these values and the Cjs. And we have these values then for the special case of Dirichlet and Neumann boundary condition. And if you believe this relation, this is in three-dimensional direction, you would get a critical enhancement. You would get for the Neumann boundary condition a ratio, an enhancement of 25% over the bulk value. Yeah, but Monte Carlo calculations for the lattice show that the special point is you need an enhancement of 50%. So you are really in the subcritical regime if you have Neumann boundary conditions. Now let's go on large scales. What's happening on large scale? We've seen that already qualitatively. Let's first study the case of subcritical enhancement. This is usually called ordinary transition, ordinary surface transition. We can get this behavior I showed in a systematic fashion by using what is called a boundary operator expansion. Basically, this is very simple. The order parameter is expanded in boundary operators. And since we have the Dirichlet boundary condition at the fixed point, the leading operator is a normal derivative. Now, the normal derivative has a different scaling dimension as the order parameter. And the distance must match. So, I mean, you have renormalization group equations for both correlation functions with this operator and that. So you compare and you find precisely the behavior I've shown you. And this has been established many years ago in detail. On the other hand, let's look at the case of critical enhancement. So this is now the renormalized C0 means critical enhancement. Yeah, it corresponds in general to a non-zero bare value. In that case, the order parameter does not vanish at the surface. So you can do the same thing. You determine the scaling dimension of the order parameter at the surface, and you know this. And then from the difference, you see that you get the scaling behavior I've showed. And the important point is that for this, in this case, the Neumann boundary condition is not associated with a fixed point, neither with a stable nor with an unstable fixed point. And that's why having Neumann boundary condition on small scales will lead to another boundary condition on larger scales. So let me then tell you a little bit what had been done before. The first systematic study of the Casimir effect, this was done in a paper by Szymanczyk, and Szymanczyk actually computed the Casimir amplitude to first order and epsilon for Dirichlet-Dirichlet boundary conditions. And around 1980, I mean, the field theory of boundary critical phenomena was developed, and in 91 and 92, Michael Krech and Siegfried Dietrich, they computed not only the Casimir amplitudes, but also the scaling functions of the surface free energy and the Casimir force for five different combinations of boundary conditions. Periodic, antiperiodic, Dirichlet on both cases, both plates, and then Dirichlet and critically enhanced, what I call special on the other plate, and both plates critically enhanced. I should perhaps add that what I didn't say, I mean, this is makes you have a restriction. I mean, this is for the scalar case n equals 1, right? Of course, if you have an XY model, then in three dimensions you can't have an ordered surface phase. Yeah? So you'd have to go in higher dimensions. Anyway, I mean, the calculations are done in 4 minus epsilon dimension as a function of n, and you have the just one has to keep that in mind. And what was seen, and that was quite a nice experiment, a nice result, is that the delta can have either sign, and it has, it is corresponds to attractive forces when you have sort of symmetric situation for the periodic case, Dirichlet, Dirichlet, and special, special. In the other case, if you have asymmetric cases, you get a different negative sign. And what do you have to do? Well, you, I'll not present any details, but I mean, you have basically to compute, you make a loop expansion of the free energy, and you have to subtract bulk pieces and surface pieces, and this involves a free propagator, where you have here the discrete k values, and these are the eigenfunctions satisfying the boundary conditions. So it's quite complicated calculation if one does it correctly. And nevertheless, I mean, for these five boundary conditions, you have some simplifications. And one of the simplifications is you know these eigenvalues Km explicitly. Here I show just examples of the free propagator. I mean, this is what everybody knows. I mean, in periodic case, you have just plane waves. So these are the K values. Dirichlet case, you have sine functions, Neumann case. I mean, I should say in mean field theory, the special special is the same as Neumann boundary condition, right? So that's why Neumann boundary can come in here, in the free propagator. And you see, there are two boundary conditions which are have a specialty, namely periodic boundary conditions involve a zero mode. And also the free propagator for Neumann bounding has a zero mode. This means that, you see, if you go to bulk TC, then this would vanish, and taking P equals zero, you have a true divergence at the bulk critical temperature for the finite system. So if you have a zero mode, it gives you something physically incorrect, even qualitatively incorrect, but it predicts a transition precisely at the bulk temperature. This is different in the Dirichlet case. You would get a shift of this temperature because there is no zero mode, and also for the other cases. Now, in the calculations originally, I mean, you look at the zero mode contributions to lowest order, and you see, well, it's not L dependent, don't worry too much about it. Unfortunately, that is too simple. One is not, I must admit, they showed, of course, me the calculation, and I said I didn't see it at the time when they had done it, that there were some problems. Anyway, here are results. These are the results of Krech and Dietrich as a function of m extrapolated to three dimensions, 4 minus epsilon. So you see, this is n equals 1, n equals 2, n equals 3, and this is n equals infinity. Now, one can, on the other hand, compute for the case of periodic boundary condition the three-dimensional case as n goes to infinity, because it's equivalent, we know from Jean Stanley, to the large n limit. So this curve here was computed by Daniel Danchev. It's the exact result for the large n case. And you see, what is really troubling is that as n increases, you move away from the exact curve. But there is more. And if you look at contributions next order, well, this would be a typical contribution, then you see if you split this in non-zero mode contribution and zero mode contribution, now then this piece here at bulk TC will be finite, and this will be finite and non-zero, an L-dependent term, but the thing in the middle will diverge. So it's really ill-defined. I mean, and then there were also some problems which were actually already noted and are discussed in the paper by Krech and Dietrich, namely, if you have a finite system and look at bulk TC, there shouldn't be singularities. And this, of course, implies that the scaling function have to have certain properties to comply with these requirements. And for the other boundary conditions, they did. But here, they did only to first order an epsilon or so. They did not generally. And one can do better and can improve this by building on work that was done for fully finite systems by Bresantin, Justin, and Ratnik, Gu, and Yasno. The trick is you have to separate the zero mode contribution from the non-zero mode contributions. And then you construct an effective action. This is an effective D minus one dimensional action depending on the zero mode. This is now a field. It's not just a number. It's really a field depending on a D minus one dimensional coordinate. And you use the renormalization group improved perturbation theory to determine this. And of course, this is, if you go higher, this is a mess, and you get non-local interactions which decay on the scale of the bicorrelation length and so on and so forth. But anyway, you see, this is what you get at lowest order is red means the zero mode and blue is the non-zero mode. So this is owing to the coupling of the zero mode to the non-zero mode, you produce a shift where it provides, the non-zero mode provides, so to speak, a mass which make them non-critical at bulk TC. Yeah, and you can include then this shift and do the calculation. So you get first one piece from the non-zero mode to the free energy. This is precisely what is already in Brecht and Dietrich two loop order. And then you get from the zero modes, you get in terms like this. And of course, I mean, this involves a mass which goes as proportional to the coupling constant. So it's, you can compute this and it's proportional to U star to this power. And as a result of that, you get a breakdown of the epsilon expansion. You find epsilon 3 half terms, 5 half terms, and also there are modulo logarithmic terms in higher order. And you might say, well, does this make sense at all? We can check this, and we check this by looking at the large n limit for the case of periodic boundary condition, and the results agree.
Could you say why the, I didn't understand why the square root terms came about?
Yeah, well, you see, you have here, this is a log of a determinant, but I mean, there is the mass term which is in here, it's this shift, if you add it by TC. So this diverges like a mass to this 3 minus epsilon is half, right? That's how it depends on the mass squared, this term. And the mass is at TC just the shift. So it's linear in U star if you go at the fixed point. So you get something which produces this non-analytic dependencies on epsilon.
How does it go away as L goes to infinity?
Basically similar, because at N equals infinity, I mean, you just have to include this term, and then you can check. I mean, the behavior, we check really the epsilon 3 halves terms, even the coefficients we getting, we take the limit n going to infinity and they agree. Yeah. And I should say, I mean, after we had done that and published and no referee told us, I discovered that, of course, in the case of quantum systems, if you're looking at quantum criticality at t equals zero, you have then also to study, instead of four dimensions, you have three as the upper critical dimension, because the quantum system corresponds to a D plus one dimensional system. And Subir-Sachdev, for the case of periodic boundary conditions, he also found this breakdown of the epsilon expansion. But we did it for both cases of zero modes. And here you see, I mean, the first two terms are just those which come from the non-zero modes, and fortunately, I mean, the correction from the zero mode is of order epsilon 3 halves. I mean, had Krech and Dickel looked at other quantities, I mean, they would have noticed the breakdown already earlier. I mean, certain things, but they didn't. And likewise for the amplitude of the for the special case. And as I said, you see, if you take the limit n going to infinity of these quantities, you can check these coefficients and with the large n limit, and they agree. only for the periodic case. For the special, I mean, you would have to consider a much more complicated spherical model, which can only be solved by numerical means. We didn't do it for that case. So much for the amplitudes. And now you can, of course, ask, what about the scaling functions? The scaling function, if you go away from TC, of course, you don't have, the zero mode also has a mass and is formally well behaved. But of course, as you approach the bulk criticality, you must recover the epsilon C half terms. So you have to match the behavior of the scaling function appropriately to recover the value here at zero. This is and that's what we did here. And you see the red curves are those of Grech and Dietrich. This is n equals 1, so I mean it agrees better also with simulations meanwhile, even though one should say, I mean, it's not a great improvement and one there's still room to do better, right? I mean, we did it at the time as best as we could. Here again, you see, and here you see, I mean, for the n equals infinity case, it goes down. The exact result would be a little bit higher than this. I might come in near 0.3 like this. So it's certainly an improvement, aside from the fact that the theory remains now well-defined all the way down to bulk TC, in contrast to the previous work. Now, then coming to the more general case, I mean, I promised that I would give some evidence for the scale dependence. And in order to see this explicitly, we decided, we generalize the previous calculations by allowing different critical or subcritical enhancements on both plates. In this regime, any value. So we did generalize the calculation for arbitrary C's in this regime. And I mean, that's for the moment, only if both are zero, we would have a zero mode problem. But for the moment, let's assume that at least one is not zero. Anyway, we can do this calculation. And now you see that this is really not a trivial step. I mean, it's kind of a hard problem because now, you see, the KMs are not known for general C. One boundary condition tells you that the eigenfunctions are phase-shifted cosine functions. The other boundary condition on the other plate then tells you or determines the values of the discrete Ks. And these give transcendental equations. So the Ks would depend on L and also on both values of the bare Cs. So you cannot proceed in this naive fashion, and I will just tell you what one has to do. I mean, there are known tricks that can be adjusted, and this is the so-called Abel-Planar techniques. The basis is the following. You have to compute sums of this form with various exponents here, and you find then a function f of k such that you can rewrite this as a residue of such a term. And then you can use complex integration. You also have to make sure that everything is properly analytically continued, that you make proper subtraction so that you don't get problems at infinity and so on and so forth. Anyway, this can be done. And Felix Schmidt, a diploma student, really did it. And here are results. I apologize, this too, I overlooked in the paper, it's correct, this should be a 1, like here, right? You see, what is plotted here is C1 and C2, and the reason why we plotted C1 and C2 over C1, because we want to cover the full range from 0 to infinity. So this is C1 equal to infinity corresponds to 1, and likewise here, from here we go, right? And what you see is, previously, we had here just an amplitude, Casimir amplitude. Now it's a scaling function. And this exponent phi is this crossover exponent, which comes in here. And what you see here is this scaling function. And these lines show where the amplitude changes sign. And then you can, of course, let's say if you pick one equal to zero, for example, and the other different from zero, then you would flow in a, along this direction, then you can cross this line, you can have a change from one type to the other type behavior. You see this better in the next picture, which is not in the paper. Here are shown contour plots. So these thick lines are the zeros, where the sign chain occurs. And then you have contour lines, and then you see here these lines. Suppose I pick C1 and C2, and now I increase L, then I would go along this direction. So what you see, you would, as you increase L, starting a point like that, you would go from, this would be small c, so you would go from attractive behavior to repulsive behavior, and you actually can also go back to attractive behavior.
The same plot you actually get if you just take two plates and you put Hobbin boundary condition, that's, and then you get the C1, C2 on the two plates, and just do this for a non-interacting field, you get identical plots with the same black curves for the sign change that we did 1 or 2 years ago, so you get the same thing. Actually, it looks identical to the plot you get.
I see.
It looks pretty, I mean, the curves, yeah, the shape, and you get this change of sign 2 times if you go along the change of separation. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's like.
Well, I mean, here it's really, I mean, the full scaling function extrapolated to
the
German.
Just talking about the curves before, you find the sign change.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of course, I mean,
that scaling function goes to something as epsilon goes to zero, it doesn't disappear in time.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So I think what we.
It's a scalar case, if you set epsilon equal to zero, if you're just a scalar case, and then you should get the same in three dimensions. Yeah. And here's the same plot for the force. Right, again, you have here the zeros. And the scaling function for the force is, of course, directly related to the scaling function of the free energy, right? I mean, you could just do the calculation. And again, here you see these contour plots. They will go in this following fashion. You can have these sign changes. So that's basically what I wanted to say. Here you see for a specific value, I've chosen here just to show it. You see, if I set C equal to zero, so C is critical and C2 is a little bit subcritical, then both are small in the beginning. It's a symmetric situation. You should first see an attractive Casimir force, but then C2 increases as the length scale increases. So then it will be an asymmetric situation and you will get a repulsive force. And that's what is shown here. And if you make the other way, then you start with a large C1 and a small C2. Then first you have an asymmetric situation and C2 will also, both will go to infinity. And then you will have a crossover from repulsive to attractive forces.
This is just
at TC. Yeah. This is all besides the TC. Oh, yeah, well, one could generalize it as a function of temperature, but this is more than one can do in a diploma thesis in one year. And that. Okay, so let me then perhaps summarize. I mean, on the one hand, you see these zero mode problems have to be taken seriously. There's a breakdown of the epsilon expansion. One can sort of repair things by proceeding in the way I described. Nevertheless, I mean, the problem remains sort of hard to get good approximations for the scaling functions by analytical tools. Then quite generally here, as I pointed out, the boundary conditions are scale dependent. And actually, this is something that has also been realized in quantum, in high energy physics and lattice theory. Martin Luscher pointed out that you have natural boundary conditions like Dirichlet boundary conditions. I would say those corresponding to a stable fixed point, and then Neumann boundary conditions, which do not correspond to a fixed point. If you want, if you wanted to do a simulation for on a lattice and wanted to have Neumann boundary condition on larger scales, then you have to be very careful. You have to adjust your lattice constants in a scale-dependent fashion to get that. So this is something he pointed out, I guess, 1 or 2 years ago. Then, of course, the Casimir force can be attracted in repulsive, even for the simple geometry, right? And in general, one must be prepared to see such a crossover. Now, can this be seen in an experiment? Surely, I mean, if the people in Stuttgart or Hucht would do the simulation, they should be able to see that. In a way, I mean, when one sees something like that in experiments, if you're looking at binary liquid mixtures, because you see, if I wanted to see this in experiment, I would have to find out how to tune the case somehow. And then if you have in mind binary liquid mixtures, you generically get symmetry breaking terms at the surface. So the situation is somewhat different. So from an experimental point, it's more favorable to look at binary liquid mixtures, but then you're not focusing directly on the fluctuation-induced force, because you will always, below and above TC, you will have a non-fluctuating background. But anyway, okay, that's basically what I wanted to say, and thank you for your attention.
Can I just make an anecdotal comment? If you calculate the pressure in massless 5⁴ quantum theory, you do in fact get a power series which is fractional power, so it's a coupling constant, precisely because of the zero mode problem. And in QCD, the magnetic modes have a severe problem because it's only two loops that you get an induced mass. And then actually, it's not even fractional power, it's just a set of terms which are equally important. It's an unresolved issue.
Yeah, that's probably, QED is of course a different story, but as I said, if one looks at the investigations of Zajtsev, he really looked at the quantum case and then at low TC and wants to see you also have a dimensional crossover there, then there is a narrow regime you find. I mean, you have, if this is temperature, you have at zero temperature transition and then a line as a function of a parameter which comes out. There's a narrow regime where the you have these troublesome pieces. I don't know. Am I supposed to ask people?
I was just wondering whether I interpreted the last transparency correctly, so that you can have both stable situation with two plates and repulsive neutral.
Yeah, in principle, you could change L to find an equilibrium, sort of say, where the force vanishes if you want.
That wasn't your last transparency.
Yes. Sorry. Yeah. So it's always. I mean, this is just for a specific choice where you have. I mean, before we had these curves, right, where they were zero, the force was zero, right, and here it's just, of course, for, since I've chosen just two examples, two C1 and C2s, so you have just here. Zero on here. It's just accidental that they almost cross at the same, go to zero at the same point.
Isn't that Hoch get a different answer than Danchev? your dynamic crashes, basically due to the boundary condition?
Hoch gets a different answer. Well, good calculation might crash, and oh, you mean the simulations?
Simulations, right. So do you agree that?
Well, I mean the simulations. Yeah, sure. I mean the simulations by Grech and Danchev were only done for periodic boundary conditions, because I mean they use this trick where you compute the stress tensor and you explicitly use the fact that the stress tensor is you have translation invariance. And I mean, there have also been some ideas to use that for other boundary conditions, but one can see then that the term that is neglected is not small. So, yeah. Whereas in Hoch's simulation, same as in your simulations now, I mean, there is no term neglected, right? I mean, so they are more reliable then. And also not, they use free boundary, for the lattice systems, free boundary conditions. Right? And that would be nice to also vary the couplings on the surface to see what's happening. Right? Because as I said, I mean, there are examples also for semi-intrinsic and by Michael Grech, where if you vary the couplings at the surface, you see that corrections to scalings are suppressed if K1, I've forgotten the precise value, is somewhat less than the bulk coupling, but it should not be zero. If it's zero, then you have no interaction between neighboring spins on the surface, so it's also clear that this would be a bad representation of the Dirichlet boundary condition.
For surface fields that are non-zero, this presumably naturally extends to description where you have a scaling function then of the argument H1, which is a surface field times
yes.
L to the power YH surface
sure.
over nu.
Sure, yes. Sure. Yeah, but as I said, right, if you include the surface fields and then you, in mean field theory, you find a non-vanishing profile, right? And then you, you, it's...
arbitrary surface. And
find a
rich behavior. But then,
at
varying temperature, you can,
or the
it's mean field theory, right?
Or, yeah. Okay, no more questions.
Okay, thanks.